It's Wednesday, September 19th, 2018, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Mike McKean, and here with me are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Ernest Perry and Stacey Wolfel.
Hello.
On our program this week, CBS News fires the head of 60 Minutes, not because of sexual harassment, though he's accused of it, but because he threatened a reporter in a text message. The Me Too movement has impacted many aspects of journalism. For photojournalists, it may be their turn. A prominent researcher says news organizations need to do more to avoid being manipulated by extremists. The New York Times apologizes for an inaccurate story about America's UN ambassador, and a Weather Channel reporter is mocked for a windy performance during Hurricane Florence. But let's start with this week's bombshell from California professor Christine Blasey Ford. She accuses Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh of attempted rape at an alcohol-fueled party when they were both in high school more than 30 years ago. This is potentially the story of the year, and there's a lot to unpack, so let's get started. Reporters immediately drew comparisons to the Anita Hill-Clarence Thomas hearings from the early 90s. Ernest, what are the similarities and, more importantly, I suppose, the differences between those two cases as they happened and as they were portrayed in the media?
Well, I mean, the similarities is with the Anita Hill case for this one is the fact that you're talking about a sexual harassment case, and there was Anita Hill with Clarence Thomas back during that time, and now you have this one with Kavanaugh. And the issue that I have with this, which is the same one that came up back during Anita Hill, is the timing of when the information was presented. It was sort of after the initial hearings had been done, and then all of a sudden, boom, it hits, and now you're having a call for a special hearing, more investigation. Those are the similarities of that case. I would say the differences here is that back during that time period, the Senate Judiciary Committee was made up of all white men, and they were interviewing an African-American woman about a sexual issue involving a African-American nominee for the Supreme Court. That drew some stark contrast there. Here, you're going to have a different makeup if the hearing actually takes place, where you're going to have some women who are on that committee and some men, but you're still going to have that polarizing effect that both from Anita Hill and this case.
There's still white men as the Republican senators in the majority on the committee, and there's some talk, Stacey, that for optics at least, they might, if Ms. Ford comes forward, that they might have a female staff member ask the questions as opposed to having them grilling her the way that the senators did against Anita Hill.
Well, and optics are what will matter here, because this will obviously be heavily covered. We'll see this available to watch this live anywhere we want. And so going into an election period, a white male senator of either party, frankly, probably doesn't want to look like the one who wants to ask tough questions of this woman.
Well, and of course, what we don't know, the big question still as we're taping this on a Wednesday afternoon, is whether, in fact, Professor Blasey is going to testify on Monday or whether she will refuse, because her attorneys were saying yesterday and today that she wants the FBI to investigate her allegations first, and then she will appear. Of course, if she doesn't appear, will the Republican senators who control the Judiciary Committee just push it forward without her? Can they afford to do that?
Well, I mean, I think that they would. If it comes to the point where she refuses to come before the committee, they're gonna move this forward regardless. I mean, I think the scenario is already in place for him to be approved by the committee, goes to the full Senate. He's going to wind up being the Supreme Court justice. It's the optics, as Stacey talked about. How is this gonna look going into the midterm elections?
And if this event does occur, the hearings, as you said, Stacey, it is going to be a spectacle. It's going to be a live news event, uninterrupted coverage. Millions of people are going to be watching at work and at home. So the stakes are going to be incredibly high if that actually happens.
It is. And a lot, again, you think about Anita Hill. And so those people who are around at that time, that was televised on, we had three networks to do that. It's the early days of CNN and so on there. But now that will be reaching people in many, many ways. I think the networks will break in to cover that in their programming, but also will have that covered and commented on and twisted and shaped by social media and everything else that comes with it.
I mean, I am really surprised, to be honest with you, at the level at which the congressional Republicans, including the Mitch McConnell and others, are very careful about how they're talking about this. And
President Trump, too.
President Trump,
who's
too.
Who's not usually careful, yeah. And it's been amazing how careful he is in terms of what he says.
That's the part that has amazed me about this, is that they're trying to make sure that they aren't saying anything that sort of creates this aura of believability by either of Kavanaugh or Ford in this sense.
Well, and I think any of the senators who will end up voting yes on his nomination when it reaches the full Senate are crafting statements now about how important it was to hear from her and that they took it into account but still thought that he should be the
And that could have a big justice. Impact on some of these close Senate races, including the one here in Missouri.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, right now it's neck and neck between McCaskill and Hawley. And there are people who are looking at how is she going to vote on Kavanaugh as the litmus test for whether or not they're going to support her. Mm-hmm.
So let's back up a little bit to how we got to where we are today. So we were told that Senator Dianne Feinstein, the ranking Democrat on the Judiciary Committee, had been aware of Christine Blasey's allegations since July, but it was made known anonymously about a week ago, and it was revealed, her name was revealed, that is, only a few days ago. So supporters of Kavanaugh, including some conservative media outlets, say they smell a setup.
Well, I mean, I think... In this case, they're probably, I don't know about a setup, but they definitely waited until they exhausted everything else to go after Kavanaugh, and then all of a sudden, boom, this pops up. So there's some credence to what they're saying about, hey, wait a minute, if you knew about this in July, why didn't you bring this up earlier? Why wasn't it investigated earlier when we did all the other investigations? Why are you waiting until?
But of course, she says, Stacey, she said that I didn't want to be outed because I feared exactly what's starting to happen to her. That she sent the letter to the senator but didn't want to have her name revealed. And it was only after reporters started sniffing around through some leak from somewhere that she decided she needed to control her own narrative.
Which I think is smart. It leaked somehow. We don't know whether it was Feinstein or somebody on her staff or somebody else. But once it was leaked and people were asking, then I would want to control my own narrative about it too. The other thing I was going to say is it's not a complete setup by the Democrats in that we know that there seems to be credible evidence that she told a counselor and her husband about this years ago, long before anybody would have thought Kavanaugh would be more than a federal judge.
It also didn't take long for some outlets on the right to start smearing the accuser. Yeah, so we had one claim that Kavanaugh's mother, who was a judge at the time, ruled against Blasey's parents in some sort of property foreclosure case, and it turned out she really didn't, that she was somehow tied to the Steele dossier against President Trump. She wasn't, that her students gave her poor ratings online when they'd actually gotten the wrong Professor Ford. So I guess we can expect probably more of the same.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's going to be a smear campaign. I mean, there's smear campaigns on both sides. There's been a smear campaign on Kavanaugh since he was first announced by the president. And now you're going to have it going in the other direction on Ford.
There's also a piece that we have linked on our links blog where the author is taking exception to some news organizations who are labeling in their headlines at least what Blasey Ford alleged as sexual misconduct instead of sexual assault or attempted rape. Is that a fair criticism that we shouldn't be, quote, whitewashing what exactly happened in as far as she's alleging anyway?
I guess misconduct is a broader term, and so people are hedging a little bit with that. That could be anything from office harassment, what Anita Hill says she put up with, to sexual assault. So based on the details that have now come out, particularly as she's come forward, it seems like alleged assault is a word that can be used.
Well, Ronan Farrow's tireless reporting on sexual assault and harassment, or whatever you want to label it, has helped to bring down several powerful men in the media, including Harvey Weinstein and, last week, the CEO of CBS, Les Moonves. For a few days, it looked like another CBS leader, 60 Minutes executive producer Jeff Fager, might survive despite allegations of misconduct that Farrow documented against him. Then Fager sent a text to the CBS News reporter who was assigned to the story.
I am that reporter. Since Jeff Fager publicly referred to our exchange today, I want to be transparent about it. First, here's some background. Sunday evening, I reached out to Fager for comment on the articles alleging he groped or touched CBS employees at company parties. In addition to denying these charges, Fager in a text said to me, quote, If you repeat these false accusations without any of your own reporting to back them up, you will be held responsible for harming me. He went on to say, be careful. There are people who lost their jobs trying to harm me. And if you pass on these damaging claims without your own reporting to back them up, that will become a serious problem.
Well, from the outside, at least, it looks like that CBS News found a legitimate way to push Fager out that didn't have to rely on some lengthy investigation of his behavior toward women. But boy, those are pretty damning text messages.
Yeah, what newsroom manager, basically what he is in this case, would send texts like that to an employee with such a threat on it? And so CBS found a way without having to air all the laundry. And once again, you know, at the same time, their CEO was on his way out, have to air any that one of their other white executives who's been in place for many, many years has had sexual misconduct in his past as well.
I mean, Ernest, I mean, it seems obvious to say that the laundry is pretty dirty and mm-hmm. that there appears to be a culture of toxic masculinity, at least within 60 Minutes.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this goes all the way back to Charlie Rose, which we talked about when that happened. And they've been investigation at both internally and externally at CBS ever since that incident. And now here we are again. I mean, I think it was 3-4 months ago, they thought they had movies out and that didn't happen. So then Ronan Farrow comes out with another one of his investigations. And now they decide movies got to go. And for him, for Fager to send that text, I can't, what was he thinking in light of everything that's happened, going all the way back to Charlie Rose and maybe even further back, for him to send a text like that to a reporter who's working on a story that he had to have known was being done, when I first read it, I was just kind of like, what were you thinking?
Well, I mean, as Stacy knows, there's this perception, probably accurate, that 60 Minutes is a special fiefdom within CBS News that can pretty much get away with whatever because they've been driving the ratings for so long. Right now, one of his deputies is taking charge, but there was a story in Variety that I found interesting that said that maybe his permanent replacement is going to be a longtime producer at the network who was actually the model for a character in an 80s movie. So, Stacy, what can you tell us about Susan Zirinsky?
Beloved character. If you're old enough to have seen the movie Broadcast News, which we former broadcasters here at the table will enjoy, Jane Craig, the character played by Holly Hunter, was based on, Coach Hunter was coached by her to get all the nuance of being a network producer, and she did it very well. So she comes with great credentials for the job. She's been running 48 Hours for a number of years. She's one of these behind-the-scenes people that the viewers don't know about, but she's been there by significant anchors and significant stories in the field and has great credentials for the job, frankly.
And she's also an outsider as far as 60 Minutes is concerned, so that would give
her some. And she's also a woman, which will save some headaches down the road, they hope.
Yeah, well, the Me Too movement has led to a reckoning of sorts in TV, as we just described, in radio. We've heard stories recently about NPR executives leaving, magazine, newspaper journalism. But there's one field, at least, where critics are saying that not enough is being done, and that's in photojournalism, where newsroom employees or members of photo agencies capture the world on their cameras. I'm curious that, at least according to one study, they found that more than 80% of U.S. news photographers are men, 80 to 95% of the lead photos published last year in the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal were taken by men. There was a recent report in the Columbia Journalism Review by Kristen Chick. It's linked on our Links blog, where she documents widespread sexual harassment by male photojournalists out in the field or at parties, even at industry workshops with young photojournalists. And Stacy, I know you've practiced and taught video journalism for many years. Would you agree that there's a big problem out there that needs to be taken care of?
There's certainly an imbalance, and we see it on the video side as well, that that vast majority of people you see working behind a camera, whether it's a still or a video camera, are men. And we graduate a lot of women from our photojournalism program here, but I think it's a drop in the bucket to who's working out there. And does sexism and abuse of that come with it? It probably does. I mean, I can remember back starting as a TV photographer that the equipment we had to wear wouldn't even fit a woman. You had to have about a 35-inch waist to be able to wear some of the battery apparatus. So the system has been stacked against women for a long time, and they've had trouble breaking in.
But as Stacey says, Ernest, there are lots of women in our TV news programs, in our photojournalism mm-hmm. programs, in convergence journalism. We're taking cameras out. So what's the problem? Is it that they're afraid of what they might have to put up with if they enter a field where 80 to 90% of the people they're working with are men who they fear might do something like this?
Well, I don't necessarily think that that's the case. I mean, for me, it goes back to who's making the hiring decisions. I mean, we talk about this when we talk about people of color, when we talk about underrepresented groups. And I think this goes directly back to that, is if you have men who are in those making those hiring decisions, they tend to hire other men. A lot of the studies pretty much prove that, and I think this is a perfect example of that. How do you change that? Well, you're going to have to move women into those managerial roles where they're making the decisions on who's going to get hired. And it's not only going to help in terms of dealing with the harassment issue, it's going to help with the actual story. Whose photos are we taking? Whose video are we shooting? And if you do that, I think you're going to see a different type of story and different narratives that come out visually than what we're seeing right now.
So I just returned this week from the annual conference of the Online News Association, and one of the most sobering assessments of where we are today came from a researcher at Microsoft. Her name is Dana Boyd, and she began the conference by showing how extremists and hate mongers have perfected the process of using social media to spread their messages, and how those of us in the mainstream news organizations are wittingly or unwittingly amplifying those messages because of the way that we cover them. Well, Boyd's comments were quite detailed and very sophisticated, and we don't have time to examine them in depth today, but I want to take just one brief example and talk about it. And that was the example of InfoWars conspiracy theorist Alex Jones and his claims that the Sandy Hook and Parkland shootings were faked. Now, what she says is that Jones and others like him start out by working the fringes. They get bloggers and ideological news sites to publish these claims, and then mainstream journalists who are out there monitoring those sites and monitoring other social media channels pick up on those conspiracies, and then we amplify them through the way that we tell those stories. And of course, we have much larger audiences, so then they get shared more and more. Then you get people like Alex Jones, who, according to Boyd at least, coins these clever search engine optimized phrases like crisis actors. And we, as traditional news organizations, publish those phrases, and that causes them to get pushed up in the rankings in Google and other search engines. More people discover them. We get this vicious cycle. Does that sound like a fair assessment to either of you?
I think it's a fair assessment. I think she's definitely onto something. When, as you say, they operate in the fringes, and then you have the mainstream media that pulls it in. And usually when we're pulling their stories in, we're pulling their stories in mocking them. Mm-hmm. But we're still giving them a platform in which to actually, you're right, to amplify what they've been saying all along. And you give them, in some ways, you give them credence for some of the things right. that they're saying.
I mean, I'll say, if the viewers and listeners only have time to read one link, read this one that's on there this week. I think it's the most fascinating read of the week. And it goes back to that tough decision we have, where I was talking about it with a class yesterday, that after Charlottesville, some things like that, we could be accused. We were accused of giving platform for white supremacists. Vice News was both praised and criticized for putting a segment together where the reporter was walking along with them in the march. But, you know, as a journalist, ultimately, I'd rather know who's out there than not, and I'd rather go for more information than less. So I think the amplification of some of this is probably something that we can't avoid.
Yeah, but that's really the problem. What do we do, Ernest? Because, I mean, it's one thing to say we ought to be aware of mm-hmm. this process mm-hmm. and how we're being manipulated, but
well, we ought to let everybody be aware of it. Yeah. Right. I mean, that's yep. the thing.
But do you cover the extremists or not cover them?
No,
do you use the phrases that they use and get them pushed up in the search engines? What do you do when it's newsworthy?
I think that you do cover them. I think you cover them. I think you put them in the proper context, and you have to ask them, when you make this statement about crisis actor, what do you mean by crisis actor? Get them to explain it so that the public knows what this. And part of it is that we will take their jargon and we just put it out there without putting it in proper context mm-hmm. and forcing them to explain what they mean by it.
Yeah. Well, of course, we've been talking about false or misleading stories from extremists, but sometimes reputable news organizations are just as guilty. So here's a case in point from last Thursday. The New York Times published a story. The headline read, Nikki Haley's view of New York is priceless. Her curtains, $52,701. The piece was about expensive motorized curtains that were installed in Haley's official New York residence. But Haley pointed out, buried deep in the story, that the curtains had been purchased during the Obama administration. She didn't have anything to do with that decision. Well, after significant criticism, the New York Times changed the headline and issued this editor's note. An earlier version of this article and headline created an unfair impression about who was responsible for the purchase in question. The article should not have focused on Ms. Haley, nor should a picture of her have been used. Well, I think we can all agree the Times blew it on that story. I just wonder if their transparency about that mistake was enough, or was the damage already done?
People aren't going to be happy either way. I don't think there was any way for them to be transparent, any more transparent than this, and make it any better, because there's two fouls here. It was a badly written headline, and whoever decided that was the photo to go with it. They probably didn't have a photo of the curtains, I'm guessing, so they put her photo in there. But it's just, what can you say that's going to make people feel better about that, particularly opponents of the time? So it probably did all that it was going to be able to do.
I mean, I went back and read it, and the whole time I'm reading it, you're right. I mean, they blew it. They blew it by not pointing that out earlier. What was the point of the story? I mean, what were they really writing about? I mean, I read it again, and I'm still wondering. Was this a story to begin with? If you're talking about the mismanagement of funds and setting up a place of residence for a government official, you could probably go all over Washington, D.C. and find that story. Why did you have to go to Nikki Haley's residence in New York?
Well, I suspect, and this is what's the more disturbing aspect of this story to me. I mean, I give them kudos for admitting that they made a mistake, but it seems to me that the reason that this story got published at all was that the Times had this narrative about other members of the Trump administration who were spending lavishly while not doing their jobs. Ben Carson and his fancy China set, or Scott Pruitt and that fancy telephone soundproof booth or whatever. Yeah, yeah. Well, now here's Nikki Haley, and she's got $57,000 curtains in her house. And that narrative just was too good for them to abandon.
Well, you open yourself up for being called, going on the witch hunt, as the president would say.
Well, speaking of alleged journalistic missteps, and I use the word alleged in this case, how about this one from the Weather Channel's Mike Seidel while covering Hurricane Florence over the weekend?
Picking it up here in Wilmington, North Carolina, right at the Intracoastal, and we're in one of these bands. This is about as nasty as it's been. We had some bands like this last night, and then the eyewall this morning. We were not on TV. It was the dark and raucous night at the hotel. And this wind gusting again over 60 miles an hour. It's blowing by pieces of limbs. This is what we're seeing, a lot of shingles coming off. You see what happens when you throw it off. It just takes off like a projectile.
Well, Seidel was the butt of many a meme on social media, because if you were watching the video of our story, there were two guys walking on a sidewalk in the background, and they didn't seem to be too affected by the wind at all. But, I'm wondering if you watch the whole thing through, Stacey, whether maybe he got a raw deal.
He might have gotten a raw deal. I have watched as much as I could find online. And we could see when he throws, again, if you're listening and not watching, he throws a shingle in the air, and it's whipped away pretty rapidly right there. So it's possible, we're playing it again here now, that there's a building blocking some of that wind back there. There is a big tree there. We can see when it goes wider. So there does appear to be different wind. I don't know if it needs quite that much bracing against the wind. The Weather Channel came out and said he'd been at it for 24 hours. He was tired. It was not a great excuse there. But
he was standing on wet grass.
Wet grass, he might slip. Yeah, something like that. So I don't think it was a attempt to deceive the audience. I think it might have just gotten a little theatrical.
What do you think, Ernest?
Well, I'm going to agree with Stacy's last point. I think it was a bit theatrical, but he's been out there for a long time. I mean, the Weather Channel does a great job at covering catastrophic storms like this, and to sort of go after one of their top reporters who if you go back and look at the body of work that he's done, he's in some dangerous situations. I don't think we should let this one incident define what he does and what the Weather Channel
does. There's a more famous case that was particularly bad, and I think you had it in the blog with the NBC reporter rowing the canoe where two people walk through in ankle deep water. She's barely able to move the canoe, and so that was certainly staged right there. But Anderson Cooper, of course, is defending himself this week because Donald Trump Jr. Tweeted out a picture of him mostly submerged, and we can see a cameraman who's only about calf deep in the water and saying, look, he's trying to make it look bad. And it wasn't even the right hurricane. So Anderson Cooper was able to defend himself and say, that's a 12-year-old picture that you've published there. And it was a different story.
It does make me wonder, though, whether we ever learn our lessons. Because going back to that NBC News piece, so it was on the Today Show. You know, what a simpler time then, right? And here's Michelle Kaczynski, a relatively new reporter for the network, as I remember at the time. And it's in New Jersey. They just had big floods and, you know, water's pouring down the street. And so somebody, the reporter, a producer, somebody decided to put her in a canoe. And she's paddling, right? And it looks like, oh, the water is really deep. And these guys come walking by and it's not even up to the top of their boots.
Right.
So they got so much criticism for that legitimately. I mean, they even made fun of it themselves on the air, Stacey, as you may recall. And yet, here we are. What is that? That was 2005, 13 years later. And still, we're trying to over-dramatize, in some instances, the weather coverage that we're doing.
It's that push. We want reporters to be performers on television. We want them to demonstrate and explain through visuals what's going on. And so there's a set of ethics that we have to use when we do that. And so here we're watching it now, if you're watching the broadcast. So you can't help but laugh as you see it. But it's not really a laughing matter to be criticized for that. I know the executives at NBC were not happy about this ultimately.
Well, and in fact, there's a later piece that she did on the local NBC affiliate where they decided to try to make up for it somehow, and they put her in a canoe in faster moving water. And you see her trying to stay in the frame, and the canoe's being pushed down the street. And yet there were still people in the background who are walking around. Right. And I just wonder, Ernest, maybe to wrap up this conversation, are some of these so heroic journalists in the face of the storm just such cliches now that they don't have the impact that they might want to have?
I think we're there where, you know, they are cliches. I would tell you what I was really more fascinated about in the coverage was the use of drones. And I think if you can do some of that and get away from the other, that's going to help a lot in changing the way in which reporters will proceed.
All right. Well, we covered a lot of ground today, but that's going to do it for this week. So thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about today on our Links blog. You can find it under the Programs tab at kbia.org. You can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @views on KBIA. These are all great ways for you to watch and listen to our program again. Leave us comments or questions if you like, and see what we're previewing for next week, and more than that as well. So thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's episode, to KBIA's Aaron Hay for handling the audio, Ellie Fitzgerald is our social media producer, and Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. I'm Mike McKean. Be sure to join Amy Simons, Ernest Perry, and me next week for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.